I am going to take a detour. You know that for the most part, I'm doing messages from the Brit HaKadoshah, the New Covenant scriptures that align, that connect to the Torah portion. Rod mentioned this week's reading from the book of Hebrews. I have decided to take an abrupt turn this week and do something else. Actually, something that I've been planning to do this week for about 6 months. It is because this week, in fact, this very day, marks the 50th anniversary of the march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. There was an earlier march in the month of March in 1965 where you had a group led by Martin Luther King. By the way, the Jewish, American Jewish leader, Abraham Joshua Heschel, which all of you should be familiar with. Karen's rabbi, Maurice Davis, was involved, marching right behind Martin Luther King. Perhaps you saw the movie recently. They're coming over the Pettus Bridge there in Selma. And as they cross, the bridge is one of those that have a big hump in it. And as they cross over the hump, they see the police people on the other side of the bridge, but they keep going. By the way, Pettus Bridge is named for somebody, believe it or not. Very ironic that this happened at the Pettus Bridge. Pettus was a Confederate general in the Civil War, and when he, after the war, he became a U.S. representative to Congress. He was also one of the state leaders where he was from of the Ku Klux Klan. So it's very interesting that this event in Selma happened at the Pettus Bridge. Pettus, who had been dead for decades at that point, but essentially, these group of African Americans and along with believe it or not, Jewish people who were of a kindred heart were basically having a prayer walk. Okay, they're having a prayer walk through the streets of Alabama when they're attacked brutally by police officers that they should be able to trust, and beaten nearly to death. No one died that day, but numerous people were severely beaten as they made a prayer walk. They actually didn't stop. A couple weeks later, on March 21st, 1965, they had another march. They were not deterred. They had another march, and this very day is the 50th anniversary of that. I wanted to take the opportunity, in light of this anniversary, to address some of the issues of racism. I still don't even know what to say about it. I have some notes. I've thought about it for months. But how do you address this? God, what can I say? Even since I decided that I needed to do a message on racism, we've had things happen in our society like Ferguson, Missouri, my home state. We had two police officers shot and killed sitting in their patrol car in New York City. We've had events in Oklahoma. We've had events across the country. Too many to even list. We've had racist events in Libya where 21 Egyptian Coptics were massacred by fanatic Islamists. We had just yesterday 130 people massacred in a mosque in Yemen, which is also racist Sunni Shiite terrorism. I believe, I'll give you my conclusion at the beginning. I believe that racism is a spiritual issue. And you're not going to hear any politician say that. You won't hear any community leader or our group leader. You won't hear the leader of the NCAA or NAACP say that. Racism is a spiritual issue. As an example of the way that racism is embedded in our American society, let me tell you a story. Last year, in August of last summer, at the National Little League Championships, a team from Chicago called the Jackie Robinson West team, which was an all-African-American, an all-black team. So I don't know what to say. So do I say black? Do I say African-American? Different people prefer different things. Some say, I'm not African, I'm American, and so they prefer black. And then other people think black is too loaded of a term and prefer African-American. So I don't know what to say. So this team named after Jackie Robinson, which, by the way, if you've not seen the movie 42, you need to see that movie. Jackie Robinson was a believer. But anyway, this Little League team named after Jackie Robinson won the national title last summer over a team from Las Vegas. It was announced, however, just last month, February, that the team cheated and their title was stripped and given to the team from Las Vegas. It wasn't the fault of the little kids from Chicago. It was actually the charge was leveled against the adults that were in charge of the team for falsifying documents, for falsifying boundaries in some of the play. The adults brought in ineligible players that actually weren't, you know, on the team, actually from that neighborhood, to help this team win. So their title was stripped and given to the team from Las Vegas. Immediately, and this is a quote from a current journal, if you'd like the reference, I can give it to you. It says, immediately, community leaders, Jesse Jackson and other community leaders and activists swung into action. The writer asked, did the reverend say that the cheating had disgraced the team and the Chicago community that was so proud of it? Did he, referring to Jesse Jackson, emphasize the virtue of honesty? No. He claimed racism and said, quote, this is persecution, end of quote. Jesse Jackson asserted, last month in February, because the team was stripped of its title, that the Little League organization in America was somehow racist. It's interesting that the same accusations of racism were raised just a couple months ago when the Oscar nominations came out for the movies from 2014. those claiming that the movie Selma was being out, was being pushed aside. If you listen to the reports, it was as if the movie didn't get any Oscar nominations. In fact, it received two. But there was all over the news for about a week. There was claims that the movie industry was suddenly racist. How short-term our memory is. Just last year, there was a movie about the African-American experience that won the Best Picture. It seems that anytime something happens in our world, there's a charge of racism. So yes, we have struggles. We might even have current race wars going on in our society. And then at the same time, we have charges of racism where there isn't any. We're trying to create a war where there isn't a war. And these things start clouding our society, and it's actually getting really darn ugly right now in our society. My dad once told me a story of when he was in college. He was attending a believing college. He was involved in led a group that in the summers would go to different cities around the United States and do outreach, urban, a lot of it in cities, urban outreach. And one time he and his group were having lunch at a diner in a city I won't mention. And one of the people with them was a black man, and someone from the diner came over to their table and said, and pointed to the black man and said, "He has to leave." When my dad spoke up and said, "If he has to leave, we're all leaving." And I've always been so honored by the stand that my father took. My dad has a close friend who is an inner city black pastor in the city where my dad lives. Racism has even impacted the life of believers. Let me give you two examples. One in the going back to the period of slavery, one from the 20th century. First, the American Civil War, which we will celebrate the 200th anniversary of the end of the Civil War just next month. The Civil War in the 1860s was preceded by tremendous strife in this country. For about 40 years, the South, particularly, had been agitated about the issue of race. There was, Karen and I just recently read a book about Henry Clay and his ongoing struggle with a U.S. senator from South Carolina. And it goes back to the 1820s, the 1830s. In 1845, 15 years before the beginning of the Civil War, there was a denomination, a Christian denomination in our country that literally split, separated over the issue of race. And so to this very day, we have a denomination called the Southern Baptist. We have a Southern Baptist denomination because in 1845, they held a pro-slavery stance. the larger Baptist movement in the United States was against slavery. I won't go into the details of what precipitated the split, but it actually was only 20 years ago, 1995, when the Southern Baptist actually apologized and renounced their pro-slavery racist roots. The Civil War followed in the 1860s. So I have a question. What would have happened if the Baptist, and by the way, the Methodists were guilty too, what would have happened if the Baptist had stood united against the evil in their society instead of fracturing like the rest of the society in which they lived? What would have happened if the Baptist stood together and proclaimed in their society the way of right? I have another story. In the next century, in 1905, there was a revival movement that came out of L.A., and it spread across the country, and indeed it spread around the entire world. It came to be known as the Pentecostal Revival. A little over 100 years ago, there were very few, calling themselves Pentecostal. By the end of the 20th century, less than 100 years later, Pentecostalism was the largest Christian movement on earth. Close to 15% of believers around the world identify themselves as Pentecostal. Did you know that revival in L.A. was led by a black man? That mission, that outreach, that revival at Azusa Street was led by a man named Seymour. It was not only was it led by a black man, the revival itself was also biracial and integrated. People from around the world came to L.A. and then took this life, this power, this new understanding of an application of what it meant to be filled with God's Spirit, which actually the Pentecostals borrowed and adapted from John Wesley and A.B. Simpson, the founder of the Christian Missionary Alliance. And they applied it to the gifts of the Spirit. It was an integrated event in the middle of one of America's largest cities at a time when Jim Crow was the rule of the land. It didn't last. Within 10 years, and I'm sad to say this, within 10 years, the whites within this revival movement separated and formed their own group. At that time, the only way to be licensed and ordained as a Pentecostal minister was through a black Pentecostal denomination. And as the society started permeating the hearts and the minds of the whites involved, they decided, well, we should go start our own denomination. And thus, the Assemblies of God was born. Which is today the largest Pentecostal denomination in the world. What would have the impact been if the racial unity of believers in Messiah had made a stand in a society steeped with segregation? we're going to go against society instead of adapting to what a society is doing. We're going to stand up and we're going to say no. So let me put it this way. Oh, by the way, what came later in the history of our country? The civil rights movement. Our country literally fracturing, attacking each other over the same issue in the 1960s. It was like Civil War 1860s all over again. Thus, both the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement, some of the most violent domestic conflicts in our history, was preceded by the opportunity for believers to demonstrate healing in a fractured world. The Baptists didn't stand together. The Pentecostals didn't stand together. Instead of demonstrating healing, they demonstrated the same brokenness that the society had. How sad it was that there was an open door that was pulled closed by believers following the trend in society instead of the teachings of Scripture. I fully believe, and I've felt this way all my life, that I myself, having come to Messiah in a Pentecostal tradition, that moment in the first couple decades of the 20th century was a spiritual door to have prevented the civil rights chaos that came later. Just like I believe the fracturing of the Baptist denomination, which at that time was one of the largest denominations in the United States, they fractured. There was a door, a spiritual door, that was open to prevent chaos down the road. In each of these, in both of these examples, God was offering believers in our country a platform to take a stand, to unite, to lead our country in a new direction, to prevent the chaos that was coming. I think there's a trend here. I think there's a pattern here. God offers us a chance to heal divisions before the destruction erupts. Our society still hasn't healed over the issues of race and division. But God gives believers opportunities ahead of time to bring healing and restoration. It's not that we respond to what happens in our society. It's that we must be proactive before things happen in our society. We have that opportunity. God gave, in both of those examples, God gave believers the opportunity to do something that would prevent the chaos, impact the chaos that was to come. When God gives an open door for reconciliation on a spiritual level, it is to avoid the future disasters in an interpersonal level, in a family level, in a civil level. It can happen in your family, between you and extended family members, between you and your children, between you and your siblings. God will give you an opportunity to bring healing. Sometimes we don't take those opportunities, and chaos and destruction will follow. This is one reason I was so glad to have had the opportunity last month to attend the Borough Park Symposium in New York City. Thank you to those who gave and contributed toward that opportunity that I had. The theme was on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And it was a group of believing Jewish leaders and evangelical Arabs coming together to discuss and to talk. An opportunity to find a way for healing, to try to stem the chaos of destruction that is sweeping across the Middle East. I'll say it again, these things have a spiritual root. Believers have a responsibility to bring healing to the things that destroy our society. Nothing happens in society that isn't spiritual. At least that's my crazy conviction as a spiritual leader. Go figure. Everything has a spiritual dynamic. And we must step up. You know, at the time of Messiah, there was tremendous antagonism between Jews and Samaritans. In fact, just right at about 100 years before Yeshua was born, a man named Yohanan Hyrcanus, John Hyrcanus, he was the grandson of Mattathias. Do you know who he was? The priest at Modin who stood against the Syrians who came to the Hanukkah story. This makes John Hyrcanus the nephew of Judah Maccabee. Okay? So he's one of those guys. He also marched up Mount Gerizim and destroyed the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim and a lot of Samaritans' lives in the mean as well. So just about 100 years before Yeshua was born, the tension between the Israeli Jews and the Samaritans were at violent forces with each other. Yeshua came into this world of tension. This is why Yeshua, at very unique times, tells stories about, well, he's asked a question, who's my neighbor? Who should I connect with? And he tells a story about a man who is beaten by some thugs. Well, not the Indian thugs, but is beaten up. And the very people who you think may be able to help, a Levite, a priest, they pass by. They're more interested in their own personal purity than in healing another person. Of course, on one level, blood, death, is something that a priest is not to contaminate themselves with. But their clinging of that prevented healing for someone that needed restoration. It was a Samaritan that came along that helped the man in need. Yeshua another time had an experience where he healed 10 people that had sara'at, which is not a physical disease, but a spiritual disease, actually, and that manifested itself in physical ways, that itchy, scaly, flaky, scratchy skin disease. And he healed 10 of these individuals, and only one came back to say thank you. And of course, it was a Samaritan. Yeshua, the story of the good news, it's pushing the people that read these accounts toward, you know, wow, you Samaritans, Man, those are people that we have that hate us. We don't like them either. Did you know that the first person in the narrative of the Besorah, the gospel narrative, that understood Yeshua to be Messiah was a Samaritan? Oh, Cornelius gets all the attention, Acts 10. What about John 4? A Samaritan, a woman. It was the first non-Jew in the Besorah to recognize Yeshua as Messiah. Yeshua used this friction to shock his listeners into unity. I'm so glad that Charlene and David sang Hine Matov today. Hine Matov Umanaim Shevet Achim Kam Yachad. Hine Matov Shevet Achim Kam Yachad. Psalm 133, verse 1. How good and how pleasant it is for brothers to dwell together in unity. It's a famous Jewish folk song, Hine Matov, based on that verse. That psalm, it's one of the shorter psalms, Psalm 133. How good and pleasant it is for brothers to dwell in unity. It goes on to say, that is where there is blessing and life forevermore. What does unity bring? Unity brings blessing. Unity brings life. What else does unity bring? As I was thinking about this, my mind went to John chapter 17, where Yeshua is praying for his Talmidim. It says, well, beginning at the first part of chapter 17, he prays for his Talmidim, and then beginning in verse 20, he prays for, interestingly, it says, prays for those who will honor you, God, through their testimony. Could even be applied to Gentiles, to non-Jews. My prayer is not for them alone. I also pray for those who will believe in me through their message, through the message of the Messianic Jews who clung to Yeshua. Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. What does unity bring? What does oneness bring? Oneness brings honor and glory. It says, let there be glory that you gave me as they remain united, as they remain one. Unity also brings an awareness, the power of God in the earth. Did you catch that line where it says, may they also be in us, may they, as one, also be in us, so that. I always love those so that passages in Scripture, because that's where we're going to learn something really interesting. In Hebrew, it's lema'an, so that, or in Greek, a hina clause. So that the world may believe. I thought of Joel Chernoff's song, Jew and Gentile. one in Mashiach, one in the olive tree. In the verse of that song, it says, and I can't remember it all right now, but it goes, you know, so that the world may believe, Jew and Gentile, one in Messiah. So that the world may believe. Our unity brings a spiritual dynamic in the earth, enabling others to believe. So there are four things, two from Psalm 133, and two from John 17. Unity brings blessing. Unity brings life. Unity brings honor. And unity brings knowledge of God in the earth. We have a very important role. Why is it that our young people... And all our young people have left the room, so I can't... Well, there's one right there. Why are the heroes of the young people negative role models, negative African-American role models? I can think of music stars, sports heroes who beat their wives. On and on it goes. I've never heard a young person or a young person who is black say, Matthew Henson is my hero. Do you know who Matthew Henson was? Matthew Henson was the one person that Admiral Perry took with him on his final push for the North Pole. Matthew Henson had been with Perry on seven of his Arctic expeditions. And when he finally came to the point for pushing for the North Pole, who was the one person he took with him, the one person he knew that he could rely on, who knew that he would be there? A guy named Matthew Henson, who, by the way, was black. From America. A full team member, not just somebody to schlep the gear, a full team member. How about, do you know who Crispus Attucks is? Crispus Attucks? Very good. Very good. Excellent. Crispus Attucks was killed in the Boston Massacre. He was the very first person to die in the Revolutionary War. I think it's a name we should know. He was black. I have a whole page of names, and I don't have time to tell you their stories. I got to tell you this one. The first black man to ever he was a poet, a playwright, the first black man to ever have one of his plays on Broadway. Oh, come on, this has a local connection. There's a high school in this town named after him. Finally, thank you. Paul Lawrence Dunbar. High school's right over here. Black man. Time does not allow me to mention the explorer Beckwith. You can drive over the Beckwith Pass in the Sierra Madre, Sierra Nevada mountains. The man who streamlined the making of shoes. The first George, the first pericardium surgery. I don't even know if I'm saying that right. Was Daniel Hale Williams, the first successful one, I should say that, the first successful surgery around the heart was by a black surgeon. Sometime watch the movie, look, are Something the Lord Has Made. It was a HBO film. You can get it at the library about the Blue Babies and the hero there. Isaac Murphy, Thurgood Marshall, on and on the list goes. So in other words, you need to tell your kids, your grandkids, to choose heroes that are supportive. Our young urban youth need to know about heroes like Paul Dunbar or Matthew Henson or Isaac Murphy or Crispus Attucks. And we, for our part, have a role to play in the chaos that's going on in our nation. God help us. God use us.